Yeah, so that's what.
We only made it salaries. Laura says we only make a positive incentive, so if someone wants to give me about 50 bucks. I'll put a dollar for everybody that's here.
Okay. We're going to continue on just a bit with the discussion of bioregions. And we'd like to draw this together and have some conclusions, and then maybe follow up with a subgroup that works on refining it. But basically, what I've heard is that everybody's in pretty much agreement that point conception is a major breakpoint in defining bioregions. And the real question is, do we need more breaks north of that for purposes of what we want to do here, which is ultimately lay out the marine protected areas? Do we need more of a breakdown north of point conception? So how many people think that we could do a quality job on marine protected areas without dividing that up, group up, that area up further? This is a straw vote. Maybe just raise your right hand if you think we could live with that.
Can we ask a quick question before we take off on this? And one of the questions is this distinction between the traditional scientific definition of a biogeographic, say, province, and because I think everybody's very sensitive to Mark's point, which is we're not here to redefine terms here. Right. However, there is what is referred to as a biogeographic province, which many of us might argue is, you know, Point Conception and Mendocino. But in the act, you yourself just slipped into referring to things as bioregions and not biogeographic provinces.
Could I propose that we defer the what we call it discussion to later?
I don't think you can.
No, I know. I'm saying that it has to be dealt with.
Right.
But I don't know how to vote. I don't know how to deal with that in a very short amount of time,
I think you might already have done it. I think bioregions is a perfectly acceptable term.
So that's my question, is whether in the Act...
It is biogeographical regions.
Okay.
And most of you today have been discussing it from that standpoint of habitat differences, species differences, et cetera, in a regional aspect. And Mark did bring up at one or two points the idea of biogeographical provinces, and I believe Steve at one point responded to that we're really not talking about provinces at all, because those are much broader, larger scale issues than what the Act is looking at. So yes, you're looking at areas with distinctive biological characteristics, and my question to the team is still based on the fact that Point Arena does not seem like a logical break.
So I guess one thing that I would recommend, though, is if we continue to pursue down this avenue, is we make it somewhere clear here what we understand a biogeographic province to be, right? We're not redefining it, but we're considering some other unit, like a bioregion, which is what we believe to be the more appropriate unit for referring to replication of reserves, or just general design of reserves. Yeah. MPA, sorry. Is that clear?
Yeah. That's good, and I think when we get to the sub-team task here of writing something up for this, I think that needs to be included as a brief description of what is scientifically understood as a biogeographic province and what is understood by the Act and by the team as a biogeographic region.
If you could just say, and what is understood by the team as a bioregion, without saying biogeographic,
I think I can't. Because the Act says biogeographic.
Okay, can I just state what we, for purposes of planning marine protected areas, off the California coast. We believe that two regions would suffice with a break at Point Conception. Is that, that's pretty clear?
Who's we?
I take that as a couple of no's.
Come on. Help me out here.
Well, what's surprising to me here, Steve, is this is a very different kind of question than we were talking about before lunch.
Yeah.
And we've gone from a discussion of the science of biogeography, which is our purview, to something that is very different than that.
Yeah.
So to me, it's an unanswerable question because you need to know how you're planning to go about it. And can you possibly design a marine protected area network without dividing a coastline into 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 bits? Of course you can. It depends on how you go about it. And and so we have been going about it under a certain idea that we were given a part of coastline to think about, and that a part of that was going to be part of a pilot project. And now that's all poofed gone away. So that's why I'm a little confused right now why we're talking about in these terms.
Maybe we, the science advisory team, can say that Point Conception needs to be a boundary. And now we're unsure about. And can we say that south of Point Conception seems to be one region?
And if for premise of this question is that biogeography is an important determinant of defining the regions under which these networks are going to be designed.
Yeah. Would you care to state what you think we agree on?
I think we agree that there are biogeographic regions that differ along the California coast. The southern point is Point Conception. There are other points along the more northern part of the coast that include Monterey Bay as a strong one, San Francisco Bay, and from what we were talking about earlier at lunch, Cape Mendocino.
Okay. Can
I think
we,
that's where that's, we got as a
that's
consensus.
Where we are. Okay. If Carrie, if you can... what I'm trying to do is just get a... clearly state what we do agree. Yeah. At this point, then we can ask, do we have to do more work?
Yeah. And if we can, stay away from the biogeographic province concept, I think we can agree that there are clear differences in the habitats and community compositions in some of those areas we just described.
How are we doing? Kent, do we want to add that I heard earlier that looking at it from a community point of view is more meaningful than looking at it from a species point of view? That seemed to be.
Yeah.
Steve.
So I think we all need to hear what the passage is in the law, because that's what we're coming back to. That's what's driving this. And essentially, as I understand it, the team is essentially asked whether or not to modify what is listed in the law as the three biogeographic regions. And those three biogeographic regions, I believe, involve Point Arena as a boundary. So it doesn't talk about biogeographic provinces. And not only that, I think the law actually qualifies what biogeographic region is because it indicates that these, I believe, are regions with distinctive biological characteristics or something to that effect. If John wants to read it, can read it. So distinctive biological characteristics is a lot different than the biogeographic provincial range endpoint boundaries that we had sort of thrown out on the table this morning. So the key question is are those three areas that are stipulated in the law fine, or can we do a scientifically better job of identifying what those ought to be using the criterion of distinctive biological characteristics? I think John said several times that he's a little unhappy with Point Arena because he doesn't see much justification for that. And I didn't hear any justification for that in the conversations this morning or in any of the data that were shown. So I think I would just quickly propose something here and throw it out for discussion. It seems to me that Point Conception South is clear. We all have agreed with that. The data that Steve showed, the work that I have seen and studied, would indicate that Monterey Bay is in the next place. So Point Conception to Monterey Bay would be another region with distinctive biological characteristics. And it looks like Monterey Bay to Mendocino would be a third, and Mendocino North would be a fourth. And I'll just throw that out there and start.
Okay, that's pretty close. Point Conception, Monterey Bay, Point Conception.
He left and out San Francisco.
San Francisco.
Well, he didn't mention San Francisco.
No.
He didn't include that, but
do you want to put,
I think some of us would.
You would like to include that.
Now, yeah. I think San Francisco Bay is obviously an enormous influence on the coastal system. Also, there's nothing that says that these biogeographic regions with distinctive biological characteristics need to exactly match the planning regions that go on. Now, that does bring, I think, some interesting issues on the table, because I don't think it's such a great exercise, you know, to set a planning region up which has a boundary right in the middle of it. So half of your activities in one of these regions and half is in another. I think that makes for poor or reduces the probability of good planning in terms of trying to achieve networks and connectivity and other kinds of replications and so on of habitat. So ideally, the region would overlap with the planning activity. That can't happen if we're going to try to look and isolate these out on distinctive biological characteristics. Last meeting, we heard some, I think, very good discussions from the socioeconomic standpoint about some of the things that need to be strongly considered in deciding where a planning region is. And I think our number one, I think our top, I wish we were able to make a top choice. I think we had two top choices, and I can't remember, I think, how they laid out. But one of them, I believe, was from Point Conception to Año Nuevo, which would put it pretty closely into that second category there, Conception to Monterey Bay. But I think the data, so San Francisco to Monterey Bay is thrown in there. That's not something I said, but what the heck.
I'm trying to.
The data would indicate that we're shown, would indicate that Monterey Bay is clearly a place where there is a transition in these regions with distinctive biological characteristics. There's a good argument for Mendocino. It's in the old algal literature as well, although the issue there is how much good cataloging has been done along that part of the coast. So that may or may not, you know, be a really good, strong boundary. You have to go on the best available information that you have. So you should put up there Mendocino to the north, then, as your fifth one.
Okay. So now we want to say that these any comment on this?
Yeah. I guess what I've seen and what I heard from the conversation this morning was that clearly Conception to the south, and clearly, albeit with the, I think, the sampling issues that you just brought up, Mendocino to the north, but I think the areas in between are much fuzzier, and we shouldn't be treating them all that they're the same.
Okay.
There is some evidence that there are these biological changes, community changes within that region, but at least from where I sit, which mostly has to do with pelagic organisms and seabirds and marine mammals, I don't see those, and I didn't see that illustrated this morning. And so I think that, you know, with invertebrates and some of the benthic fishes and demersal fishes that we looked at earlier, there's pretty good evidence, but it's not across the ecosystem. There are certain groups that seem to have boundaries, you know, at Monterey, to the north, Año Nuevo, okay, those areas, but the only two that are really clear, okay, are Mendocino and Conception.
Okay, can we add down below this, Carrie? I see the card, Rick, but that of these, the point conception is the strongest. Second is Monterey Bay.
No?
Mendocino. Sorry. Thank you.
Focal group.
Followed by Monterey Bay. Or Mendocino. And then below that, Carrie, say that these are all better than Point Arena. Okay, now can we basically, there's strong agreement on what it says there?
I had a question for Will. You were talking about birds and marine mammals that didn't necessarily follow those breaks between Conception and Mendocino. Are there discontinuities between those that do correspond to marine mammals and birds? Or is it pretty much more of a homogeneous mix within
much
that?
It's more homogeneous, and it's really determined by these broad-scale oceanographic factors.
Right.
So whether or not we have El Niños and PDO-related things that change on very long time scales, and, you know, you can see very large shifts in these highly mobile predators in relation to that sort of oceanography. So, but that area, at least to me, seems to be the Cape Mendocino to Point Conception really seems to be pretty clear, and how things move around in that area is really up to what's going on in a given year or given decade.
Right, but since those breaks do exist for these other taxonomic groups, then if you were to break according to those smaller groups, you would capture a good chunk of the critters that you're talking about. You wouldn't be excluding anything.
Yeah, you could break it on your way.
All right.
You know, it seems to me there's one major exception to that in the marine mammals, and that's the otters. The otters go up to San Francisco and stop, and they have such an enormous impact on the coastal environments that biologically they're very different where there are otters than when there are not. It would be difficult to generate management plans that were the same in the south where the otters were and apply them in the north where the otters are not. And that more than as a single species range change that really has a huge ecosystem impact, more than anything to me suggests that the San Francisco Bay is a really important punctuation in that long broad area.
So Steve, you're proposing that we,
if we're ranking these,
Cape Mendocino and San Francisco Bay a tie.
I would. That's what I propose. Okay. That's an important change along our coastline that we would have to recognize.
Steve, or Mark, I'm sorry.
I think this does accurately represent most of the substance of the discussion, but I think the phraseology at the bottom, second paragraph from the bottom, should change. It's not that Conception has the strongest support, you know, we're not
right.
voting.
Right.
It's that there's the most consistent evidence for across diverse marine taxa, diverse marine organisms. So I think that the different perspectives that you're hearing have to do with the different kinds of organisms that each of us is most familiar with.
Yeah.
So I think the consensus is most consistent for the broadest array of organisms at Conception and from there.
Down. Yeah, I don't mean these votes and so on to overrule the laws of physics. I think we should stick with whatever the science dictates. Darwin will take care of those people. Okay, so is this, we can agree on this then, and we'll pass this. Oh, whoops, Steve Gaines.
Just one follow-up on that. I mean, it seems to me that the different groups of species are not equal in their weight as well, because if you look at the list of species in the back of this document that are most likely to benefit, of course, they're going to be dominated by ones that are at least moderately sedentary. And so that list is going to include most of the groups that are in the data set that I showed you before, which does have those relatively prominent patterns in terms of boundaries in the Monterey and San Francisco region. The other thing that I think is important to note here is that, as Mark Carr pointed out this morning, a big component of that Monterey to San Francisco, the break at Monterey separating on either side of the bay, does seem to be a habitat issue, which we've already got covered in the discussion of the different kinds of rock type issue. And so the choice of San Francisco, or it could be the other way around, it seems to me that the distinction that's in the data that I showed today would be covered by the habitat issues if you draw either one of those as the biogeographic regional boundary.
Yeah. But from the point of view of communities, this is what we are agreeing on.
Yeah, and I think Steve's point on otters is really well taken, that such a dominant role.
Okay. All right, we can move on then. And you want to find a subgroup to work on this?
Yeah, who's willing to take what's here and prepare a couple paragraphs, maybe three paragraphs, that describe the types of input that went into this and the rationale behind it? I mean, essentially what you've done in that statement is provide some guidance to the task force as to what they can choose from, and that's exactly what we need you to do. It's in many ways better that you didn't come up with a this is what we think the answer is. So with that in mind, is there some among you who, you know, can whip up something and send it to everybody on email and get us some language to add?
What's the deadline?
Steve and Steve.
Deadline's the 25th.
25th?
Yeah.
Friday?
Yeah. Yep.
Did you want to
say? I'll give you to the 30th, actually, because we said we would discuss doing a subgroup.
Are the cards up to volunteer? Yeah. You'd like to say something?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. That
okay.
Just was
all right, who
so,
is
yeah, you have until the 30th.
I've already got another job.
All
right. Or conversely, I will write it up and I'll send it to everybody and let you take some cracks at it between now and the 30th. But I'd prefer it if one of the team wrote it up. But I guess that won't happen. So I'll write it up.
All right. So John, John Ugaritz.
Volunteers over.
Oh, there were?
Biogeography boy.
Okay.
I didn't see him.
Steve Gaines and I'll write it up.
There you are.
Okay.
And if you can get it to the team before the 30th so everybody can have a day or so to look at it and think about it, that'd be great.
All right. Okay, if there are no other comments, we'll move on to the next agenda item. No more con? Okay.
And thank you, everybody. Morning and that conversation were really productive.
I have one comment. Can you put back up what we all said we agreed on? This is a small point. Because I understand what you're trying to do. You're trying to encapsulate, you know, where we are so we can move forward.
Yeah.
But I don't know how many of us really agree with that. Of these, there is the most consistent evidence across diverse taxa to point conceptions is a clear break. Everybody's good with that, I think. Mm-hmm. But the rest of that sentence, I'm not in agreement with the rest of that. That followed by Kate Mendocino, I don't think that there is consistent evidence across diverse taxa that Kate Mendocino is the next place in the sequence where there is a clear break. I think the data are really spurious with regard to that. So I don't want to belabor this, because I think you've captured what you need to capture. But if you're going to try to do this and then we're going to come back later on and get held to this, we're going to have problems.
Okay, I think if John or if the group can craft it in a way that it
well, how about just make a new paragraph and just say
don't worry about it.
Say Cape Mendocino and San Francisco Bay also show some evidence of biogeographic breaks, and noting that Steve and Steve are going to take this and work from it. So this is not, just so you all know, this, we do not think that this is something that the whole team has agreed to, nor are we intending to put this language directly into the next version.
Very briefly, can we also incorporate in that first sentence there, or in a following sentence, this distinction between what we're referring to as biogeographic regions and a biogeographic province? So we don't lose Mark's point that we're not trying to redefine that. Okay.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Whoops.
And you might add, I can't read it, important breaks that appear for some taxa demark the boundaries of these regions. I just wanted to include the notion that the regions, the subregions that Steve showed us are clear for some taxa. We're not implying that this is universally true across all marine organisms.
Absolutely.
So that would be in the third paragraph. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, that's it. New topic. Now, John is going to talk about the Central Coast sub-team selection process.
Mark Carr just observed, we're scientists. We can do this all day long.
I know.
That's probably true. Let's move to item 5 on the agenda, which is Central Coast sub-team selection. This is another opportunity to be scientists in
Is that on now? Yeah. Thank you for hollering at me. As you remember, one of the things we are going to do is apply all of this thinking and these tools to the Central Coast Study Region, which will be defined by Blue Ribbon Task Force on April 11th. We will then start that process, and part of the design is a regional sub-team of the science team to support the regional stakeholder group there. And what we need to do today is talk briefly about the operations interactions of those two entities, the regional study group and the sub-team, and then begin to select members. And I think we earlier had a show of hands of potentially interested people, get that refined. And then the third task is for the April meeting of the Blue Ribbon Task Force to identify one or more of you that would be available to answer questions of the Blue Ribbon Task Force about the Central Coast Study Region if such questions arise in Pasadena on April 11th. First is to number A, the way in which this effort will unfold on the Central Coast is defined in the master plan framework. But let me just quickly hit the three highlights of it, if you will. The regional study group will be comprised of people identified through a nomination process and selected, and they are intended to represent a broad range of stakeholders and could include scientists as a stakeholder, people interested in collecting and doing science, as an example. They will be supported by the sub-team of the science advisory team. One member of the Blue Ribbon Task Force is to be available to work with them, and there will be a small staff also available to support their activities. That staff will include representatives of the Department of Fish and Game. John Ugaritz is now in Monterey, and we'll have some people working on that also. We'll have other people from the MLPA initiative also supporting the work. There will be a senior project manager, which are in the final stages of selecting right now. And then there will be a professional facilitation, and there will be various sorts of analytic and data collection support provided also. All of this will come together in a process that will be very short in terms of time, as the process is to be completed and delivered to the Department of Fish and Game, or actually the Fish and Game Commission, in March of 2006. It's a fast-paced march. It is anticipated the regional stakeholder group will meet probably monthly during this period of time, and their work will be augmented by a variety of workshops spread out over the region. But the science sub-team will work specifically with the stakeholder group, study group. It's my understanding in the past iterations, and John, if I misstate this, someone else can clarify, but it sounds desirable in any case, that it is the desire that at least one member from the science sub-team be available at every stakeholder meeting, the monthly meetings, to answer any questions that may arise, but that questions may be generated from the regional study group, stakeholder group, directed to the sub-team or to the whole science team, for that matter, to be taken up outside of those monthly meetings. So it will require some FaceTime presence, some work in supporting the activities of the regional study group, and it will be pretty fast-paced. It's a critical task. I mean, that's where all of this stuff gets applied and judgments are made, and the best readily available science needs to be brought to bear. I'd be happy to answer any more questions or have other people amplify what the relationship is and the expectations are. Some people here participated in this as scientists before. I know Steve Gaines did, and others around the room did also. Steve Murray, did you participate in this before? And I don't know who else has, because I can speak to it from firsthand experience. John Ugris has participated in a fish and game. Mike Weber has watched it also and participated in one way or another. What else needs to be said about the role?
So, John, would you say that this is where the alternate MPA plans or lines on the map is going to be generated from?
The result of this process will be a proposal including alternatives, and that's something we haven't figured out. I don't yet understand what it means, of MPAs and the beginning of an understanding of how they relate to one another and will fit into the network, but the network judgment is not made until you have all of them for the whole state. But clearly the sort of design criteria that were talked about here in terms of adult population, neighborhood size, and the larval dispersal, the sort of things that will be applied in this case, in this project.
And I'd say other scientific roles will be to look at the nature of the resources in the region, the existing, you know, regulations and what the impacts on the resources, things like that. So, and just to reiterate what John said, it is critical that at least one member of this sub-team be present at the working group meetings of the stakeholder group. And preferably more. It does not have to be the same member at every meeting. So, you know, you can rotate through and take turns. So I'm not saying that, you know, one person's going to have in the next year and a half 12 meetings, which is essentially what it'll be. It's probably 12 meetings between now and a year from now. So you can share that load.
Question, do you have any idea what the Central Coast region is going to be? Because that might influence, you know, who's most appropriate.
Somewhere between Point Arena and Point of that.
There was actually there was a lot of unanimity about criteria as expressed in the science advisory team and in the various stakeholder meetings and inputs that we had. We had three workshops also, and there's a lot of closure around the criteria that are important. There was also a lot of unanimity around the study region. And in pulling this together to present to the task force, I ended up identifying pros and cons, and this is available on the slideshow on the web if you've not seen it before, that looked at three choices, one of which was, if I remember correctly, of Bodega Head to Cambria, one of which was Pigeon Point, which is just north of Año Nuevo, to Point Conception. And the other one was Pigeon Point to Point Sur. And there were pros and cons of these three choices. and those were described. And those three choices will again be discussed by the Blue Ribbon Task Force, and a choice will be made amongst those three on April 11th. The pros and cons are pretty straight, pretty obvious. In a sense, the Bodega Head to Cambria encompasses, the pro is encompasses a broad swath of the coast with and it does match well with existing action going on the federal side. It the cons, I don't have all this on top of my head, the cons are it is broad and you have multiple stakeholder groups in that area, and as we've seen in this conversation about regions, it may slice. You've got probably at least two regions in it. And the pros and cons on the Pigeon Point to Point Conception, the pro, and incidentally, in this group, there was a lot of discussion about Año Nuevo to Point Conception, and the stakeholder group, they said there's a reef off Año Nuevo that we'd really like to have all encompassed, so go to Point Pigeon Point, which is 5 nautical miles north. And so we made that adjustment in the process. That matches well with the discussion that we understood coming out of this, of the prior discussions of this group as a sensible region. It encompasses areas of which there's a lot known and strong marine science institutions, which is true also of the prior case, the Bodega Head to Cambria. It's true of all three cases, actually. The cons are you've got two distinct ports in it, Monterey and Morro Bay, and there's also discussion about some fisheries come around the point of Point Conception, and particularly squid, I understand. So it's a little bit of a question about how you handle stakeholders in that case. It's also a pro of that one that when you think about how you're going to complete the task of doing the entire coast and San Francisco Bay, which we've decided as a staff anyway, we recommend doing separately, because MLPA includes estuarine waters, but the San Francisco Bay is complicated and large. We suppose doing it, you would have 5 more bites, essentially, if you did it at that scale, and that seems doable. The pros and cons on the shortest unit, which is Pigeon Point to Point Sur, pros, again, you have high valued usage, a lot of knowledge. We heard from some stakeholders, and I guess it's probably partly my judgment also and some other staff judgment as a con, that you'd force a lot of trade-offs into a small space and probably increase the conflict and make it more difficult to get good habitat replicates, et cetera. And the pros and another con on that, if you worked at that scale, you'd have to do more iterations in order to complete the whole coast. It would ease stakeholder participation in terms of physical travel, although, as I said, it might increase the conflicts. Those are the three choices that were presented. We had full participation speaking to those choices. Had we had a quorum, a choice would have been made amongst those three. On April 11th, what we propose doing is literally just representing those three options. All of the task force members will have listened to or seen, because it's all on video, the entire testimony. They will not open up to new public testimony, but they do want to be able to ask, and that's the reason down here, item C, be able to ask questions of each other, of staff, of science advisory team members, and then they'll make a decision. So that's the context.
Okay, we have a couple of action items. John, one is...
Oh.
at this point, we want to...
Well, I think we do have two action items. One was members to form the Central Coast sub-team, and we would like to have those in place by April 11th, if at all absolutely possible. I'd like to announce this as we identify the Central Coast, the science sub-team. It would be great to announce that. And then I'd like to find one or more people who would be willing to come to the April Blue Ribbon Task Force meeting to answer questions that may arise from the task force. So those are the two action items, Steve.
Okay. On the first one, how many people are we? How many people would you like on that?
I think the point that not everyone has to come to each stakeholder meeting is very critical, but I would think that if there were a group of 4 to 6 that would want to work on the Central Coast, that'd be great. If it's 3, I would like to have more. If it's 8, I wouldn't complain at all. So somewhere between that range, 4 to 6 would be great.
Okay. Then maybe we could just ask for volunteers. I think we had at the last meeting, we had some people express an interest. It was Rick, Linwood, Mark, Steve, Doyle,
Dean,
Laura. Where are we? How about Astrid? Are you?
I've got Rick, Linwood, Mark, Steve, Doyle, Dean, Laura. Is that it?
Who would marry
Steve?
Yes. Yes. We have word.
Steve. One.
I saw Gaines's finger go like this. Before he got
married. It goes into my conception.
Just yeah. Write down Steve.
sure, I'll do it. We had word from Lou Botsworth and Mary Yaklovich, that they would both be interested as well.
But with Lou and Mary, that would give you 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I suggest we take this list, and then once the requirements are really clear, how much time and how many meetings and so on, then John, somebody go back and poll the people and see if they actually can make. I think you want a high level of commitment from.
Yeah, I think this is very helpful, and I think heard Steve Gaines saying when Old Point conceptually he'd be more interested, and I think we will have a decision on April 11th, and we could then finalize it. But this would be very helpful, and so thank you for that. Who would like to come with us to Pasadena on April 11th?
Can we nominate people?
Yes. Yes,
yes. Steve.
I mean, it makes sense for me to go, Steve. But we happen to have an 8-year review on April 11th and 12th.
So I can't leave. We have outside viewers reviewing our program.
Good opportunity.
Well, this is a great opportunity.
Can I ask a question, please? I was told that one of the issues for that meeting was going to be this concept of networking and explaining that process. So that's very important.
That's something we're also going to be looking for some volunteers for, and it could be the same person.
That is a very good point. We're putting together an expert panel on the networking issue, and we will have one or more members of this science advisory team there for that, and that person could do it also if they're and trust okay. They're willing. So,
but then we have the chairs of our sub teams.
I would be happy to do it. I'm currently booked with classes on April 11th.
Okay. Do you want to designate somebody?
Well, Gaines is the obvious one because he can ride a bike to it.
That's a slam.
In 2 weeks.
Okay, that's a slam dunk.
Let's look at the expert panel and see if we can have someone play two roles, and we'll find a way to get it covered. That's
it's
okay.
Already slated, so.
What's that?
He's already slated to be called.
Yeah, we have the call list has been put together. We just haven't made the calls yet. Steve Murray wanted to say something.
Yeah, I'm just what you're looking for a person to go, or a representative from here to go to this meeting. What's the particular dialogue function?
It's a little bit uncertain. The task force will make a decision. And if they have questions of the science advisory team.
This is on the central study.
Central Coast study region. So if they had a question about what does, you know, why, what's this upwelling thing, it'd be great to have someone there who could talk about what that meant. I have no idea whether they'll even ask a question. I would expect they would. I'd say the odds are 80-90% they'll ask questions of this person. But that's not a certainty. And it won't be a public testimony or rebuttal of any of it. It'll be helping them understand the choice that they're making and any trade-offs that they may raise. So that'll be the context.
What's the time?
It will be the very first thing on April 11th on our meeting, which is either going to start at 9 or 10 a.m. So it'll be sometime between 9 and 11:30 on the April 11th.
I have classes also, although I'm pretty close. I might be able to get there in the morning for a bit.
Okay. We'll work it out. Thank you for offering, Steve.
Okay. Well, is that enough, John?
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll work with that.
Oh, we have one.
Before we leave this topic, I wanted to just, for the record, I'm not real comfortable with the whole sub-team science advisory team idea. I don't understand it. And it seems we're pulling out an arbitrary small group from this group to do the nuts and bolts of the whole process and then come back and be part of a review team for that same process. And they're not necessarily the best or right scientists for that region from the whole state. They are the scientists that are the subset from this group. So how do they interact with other scientists who might want to help form the core of the most essential part of building the MPA in that region? I don't quite understand the process.
I think if we go back to the team challenges, one of them was that we wanted to avoid advocacy. So I think anybody that goes presents and asks questions to the task force needs to do it from the point of view of the team or the science. That's an important, I think, ground rule for that.
And Jeff, is your question more specific to the Central Coast sub-team, the actual team that's working with the regional group?
Yeah, well, the sub-teams. Yeah. Next time it will be somewhere else, but that's where the work's going to be done, it appears. And so
well, the way we have framed that sub-team is such that, A, they're taking a little bit of the burden off of the whole team for paying attention to what's going on at the regional working group, but not that they won't be bringing all of those issues that need discussion back to the full team. They're essentially the conduit that provides the back and forth between this whole team and the working group and vice versa, the working group and this whole team.
But then I guess I have a follow-up question then. If the MPA is there to be science-based, I don't see the science group that's putting out the alternative proposals. I see a strong mixture of a very heterogeneous group of people who's going to send something back. And then, so we're only a critiquing body. We're not a doing body, it sounds like.
Oh, I don't see that. No, and I think an example is what we've asked you to do between the last meeting and this meeting is to actually provide the basis for mm-hmm. how to develop networks. And similarly, I think as we get into discussions on specifics, we'll be asking this team to provide that basis for making decisions. So you're not simply accepting whatever it is the working group comes up with and critiquing it. You'll be giving the scientific basis so they can provide something that's useful.
Okay.
That's the way I hope it works.
Mm-hmm. So it may be helpful for you to develop some sort of explicit protocol to make that transparent to the public. So it would be my intent to email Astrid or call Astrid during the whole process, and we have people here from the different subcommittees who should be going back to the subcommittee and saying this is where we are. But it would just be good, I think, to have in the public record some basic protocol for the way this sub-team interacts with the existing sub-teams and the larger science advisory team.
Could we put that as an action item that John Curlin and John Ugaritz and I will write up a propose a protocol, because I think whoever is going to speak should get prepped on what kinds of topics the task force is going to ask about, and then take it upon themselves to talk to whoever might have something to add to that before they go to the meeting. But that would be my model of it. On the other hand, the task force is bringing in people from other places just to get the benefit of their unique perspectives, I guess. But I think if they're asking specifically for somebody from the science advisory team, then we need some protocol.
I think, were you asking about the relationship between...
No, I was talking about the Central Coast Science.
Right. So that table that got shown this morning, that table two, was it table one? Was a diagram of the relationships between the sub-team, the science team, how those MPA draft alternative and their alternatives get created, right?
It looked like...
So maybe that would be useful to...
It looked like, Mike, maybe you can clarify, but it looked like the way it's constructed, the science advisory team as a whole has a sort of a review role vis-a-vis the Central Coast sub-team. So things would go through here on their way to the task force, basically. Is that...
Yes and no. I think Laura's correct. If you read through the table one, you'll see lots of places for...
Can we put that on the overhead?
Well, what I wanted to show, you know, for instance, under 1.2 here, develop additional criteria, the regional stakeholder group, science sub-team, and... I guess the initiative staff, is that what the MLPAI stands for? Identify issues. The criteria design comes from staff and the science sub-team, and then the review of those criteria are before the task force, the commission, and the advisory team. So, you know, everybody has various roles at various times in the process. But again, it's the sub-team is working as a part of this team. They're not some side group that's working completely independently. The intent, again, is that they're a conduit and that they bring things back and forth between this team so that not everybody on this nearly 20-person team needs to focus on it at the same time.
I have a question about the sub-team's role. Is it going to be as advisory as the SAT, or will it be more proactive, engaging in analysis, data collection, things like that?
John, the intention is that'll be a roll up your sleeves, do the work sort of a team, right? No?
I'm not sure I understand the distinction, but I mean... As I see it, this team is being active at this point, as of last meeting, and forming sub-teams and coming up with language for the master plan framework. I see that as a very active role. I see the science sub-team doing exactly the same team in helping draft criteria, helping frame scientific questions to the stakeholder working groups so that the products they develop are science-based.
Yeah. But per your own instructions last time and in the summary of the last meeting, you made it very clear that the role of the SAT was to respond with advice and not to be...
Not to develop MPA alternatives, I think is what I was saying in that last discussion. I do not expect this team to draw lines on the map and send them to the Central Coast Working Group.
Yeah, but even with criteria, and we had this whole discussion about whether we thought the Blue Ribbon Task Force criteria were appropriate, you said that it was, you know, we would comment on the Blue Ribbon Task Force, and then we could come up with our own criteria separately. And so the charge there was a little bit more reactive.
Again, you're not reviewing. You are providing scientific information. Okay? You are giving alternatives, just as you did this morning with some of the discussions we had and framed alternatives. The task force is the only group that's going to take that and make some kind of policy call on it. I do not expect this team to come up with a policy for where you place MPAs. I expect you, just as you did in the design criteria, to come up with criteria that help people frame those discussions.
Yeah, I think one way to that I think about it is that the task force has basically lifted the policy trade-off kinds of work from our shoulders. And we can really concentrate on the information, the design, and those aspects of it.
And that is why you are not selecting the Central Coast area. You provided input, and the task force is considering that input. And it, you know, as John stated, you know, it seemed like your prime candidates for areas made it to the top of the list that was considered by the task force, or is being considered by the task force, as well as the discussion of additional criteria and additional factors that come into play. All of that went to the task force for decision making.
Oh, Steve Murray.
I think we're back. What's been raised here, what Linwood raised, I think is an issue that I don't believe we resolved it well at the final stages of the process that was halted. And because I think that and just a little bit of history here, you remember that there were 7 regional working groups that were set up, and at that point in time there were only 8 of us who were doing this particular job. Each of us was assigned to work with one of the regional working groups, and we got started off on that, I think, with the same vision in mind that's here now being carried over into this. In fact, I don't know that there's a dramatically different vision, except there are more of us here, and there'll be more of us in the regional working group. But the problem, as I see it, is that even before we really got going in that exercise, I mean, we had people were coming up and asking me, you know, and the group I was working with, well, what do you think about this place, and what about that, and what were your plans, and why did you come up with this, and so on and so forth. Now, remember that when the last process was halted, there are also a whole bunch of alternative MPA sites that were generated by the planning group, the group equivalent to this, that I don't believe were ever really circulated to the public. I don't know exactly what the status of that was, because we were in the process of trying to move those along and taking in feedback and creating alternatives. And one of the very first things that, you know, I was asked is, well, let me see your, you know, what you guys came up with as your other alternative plans. Now, I see this as a problem, because if you're going to go in as a representatives of this group, if we're going to go in as representatives of this group, we certainly can be there to give advice, to provide framework, to provide data, to answer questions, so on and so forth. But there's going to be a tendency among this very diverse group, you know, to get our folks to provide solutions, which become alternatives and become parts of the mapping process. So I think it would be very important to actually write the ground rules and to give good thought to this, so that we all know what we are, you know, because everybody here tries to help with good intentions. But what will ultimately come back, and I could see the writing on the wall last time through, is that somebody would come forward with a plan, and one of the people who didn't like the plan would say, well, that's, you know, his plan, you know. And I don't think that's what we want to do. We want to come up with, I think, what are the best science-based solutions to the problem at hand. And I think we're moving along here by setting guidelines and framing criteria. I think we went a long way towards that today with particularly the document that, you know, Steve, your group put together. And that gives us some, gives folks some real idea what they need to be looking at in the way of sizes, areas, numbers, replication, so on and so forth. But we should be there, I think, to answer questions, to provide advice, to give guidance. And if the group as a whole, the stakeholder group, says, gee, we would like you science folks to come up with this or that for us, then great. But not for us to be working with individuals who want this or that to happen. And therefore, I think it's very important to lay this out, articulate it carefully. Once that's done, so let's say that this group goes off and we get reports back to our larger group here on a timely basis. There'll be some point in time when there will be plans that will be returned and brought back. Now, those plans may or may not first be believed to be appropriate based on the law and the guidelines that are set forward by the subscience team that's been out there working. And they may or may not be, you know, seen that way by the whole group as a whole. So setting up what, how the subgroup reports back to this group in terms of recommendations, pointing out problems, issues, directing discussions that may come back from ultimate solutions, I think is also important. So I would suggest that this gets, you know, written and articulated very clearly. It'll only help us, because if this is not done this way, then each of us will have our own difficulties figuring out what we should or shouldn't do, and everybody's trying to do the best job they can. I know that that's the way we all approached it last time, and that's what I see here. And that can get you into some difficulty given the way this is going to play out.
Yeah, could I say or suggest for an action item that Steve Murray, you work with John Ugaritz and me to draft some guidelines and bring them back to the next meeting, and then we'll go through a review. I think that gives us the benefit of lessons learned from the past. Okay. Great. Carrie? Well, you got it. All right. All right. John, are we finished with that?
We're finished with that item.
And the next item is also one of John's. By the way, if you haven't had a chance to read over the federal OMB peer review document, it has a lot to say about what we were just talking about and the role of groups like this. But anyway, John, it's your...
The next item is peer review. And I would like to first initiate discussion of the topic of peer review, which is required by the statute in this case, and also begin to talk about a potential process. And I don't have a draft process to put in front of you today, so I just want to initiate that discussion. And with the operational thing, which you do need to do today as an action item, is to identify portions of the master plan framework which are appropriate for formal peer review. And there are, just to remind you, there are five sections in the master plan framework: an introduction, a section on design, a section on management, a section on enforcement, and a section on monitoring and evaluation. And so we need to identify one or more of those which is subject to peer review. The Department of Fish and Game has used peer review processes before for some of its work on the nearshore fisheries, I believe, is an example. Have any of you participated in their peer review processes?
We can't say if we did.
Rick did. Yeah. Okay. As a reviewer. Yeah. So some history with that. My understanding is that in that case, the department contracted with UC Seagrant, which then assembled reviewers, and they then provided comments to the process, and there was some degree of visibility and transparency about that process. What we'd like to do now, and it'll get more concrete as we have some guidelines about how to do it, is move to a process that is, I think, a little more transparent than the process that was used in the past by the Department of Fish and Game, following generally what is outlined in this OMB discussion of late last year, November 2004, which Mike Weber found, but I also looked at documents from EPA, from the National Academies of Science. And we're looking for the source of peer review that is common for major public policies. We'll come back with a draft of what the procedural steps would be, but that's just a heads up that that's the direction we're headed. Having asked if anyone participated in the Department of Fish and Game's peer review in the past, and Rick Starr was the only one who raised their hand, has anyone participated in such a peer review for any federal agency? So no familiarity with this process.
State.
For State Water Board. Okay, and maybe later you could tell me what their process is, Linwood, so I would just know what it is also. Because we want to have a process that is sort of at the upper end of what people are experiencing. The issue of peer review is important to many stakeholders. I think it's important for the integrity of the process that moves forward and perceptions that everything is being dealt with in a balanced and fair manner. So that's where what we're thinking about in peer review. I would like to have some discussion today, and this is the action item, about the sections of the master plan framework which we would have peer reviewed. And I will just, to sort of advance the conversation, make a couple of suggestions. It seems to me the introduction is not subject to peer review. It seems to me the design section could and should be. The management section could be, but it would be a different set of reviewers. Management enforcement, if they were to be done, would be share the same sort of people, but they would be different than the design. And monitoring and evaluation, which right now is not particularly well fleshed out, but could be done, could be subject to peer review, and the people who are competent to do the design peer review could also do the monitoring and evaluation peer review. So it seems to me that as I look at this document, we have one section that clearly should be subject to peer review, and that's the design section. We could add to that a peer review by essentially the same group of competencies for monitoring and evaluation. And then if we choose, we could do a peer review on the management and enforcement section, but it would be a different set of competencies. So that's sort of framing how I see the choices before you. I'd be happy to have any alternative framing, but in order to at least frame what I think the choices are, that's a suggestion.
Any comment?
It's not clear to me. You're not talking about this group doing peer review.
No. This will be a separate group will do the peer review. All I just wanted to do is heads up, it's going to happen. This is the process we're doing. Do we have, are we thinking about it right in the sections that need to be peer reviewed? Are you, and get the people a judgment of that? That's the task today.
And I think part of what we're trying to figure out and why John sent out the OMB document on peer review. It's different than peer review for a journal article. That's not what we're looking at here. You know, it's very different than that process. And like he said, this is somewhat unique because usually, you know, the traditional scientific peer review, you get a group of anonymous reviewers, they make comments, and those comments are forwarded to an author or a group of authors to make changes in a document. That's not what's going to happen here. Whoever reviews this is going to be very unanonymous and you know, under a high degree of public scrutiny to determine if whatever the task force and the department and the commission finally decide on is based in sound science. So it is a bit different.
Just a minute, on that front, you probably want a panel of reviewers, so you say it's unanonymous, but it ought to at least be a group of people said this and not a person said this.
And actually, based on previous experience, I would suspect that the conversations of that group of people may or may not be private, that it may be public, the whole review process. So it, again, it's different, and it's very technically tricky to pull it off right. And we have been criticized as a department in past review processes because people feel that they're somewhat of a black box. That's, of course, the usual intent of a peer review, is it goes into a black box and you get your comments.
Yeah, but again, I would submit that this group could say I don't agree with that. We're saying that doesn't sound like a good idea. There ought to be an anonymous, to some degree, review process that gives you feedback and a list of critiques. You can take it or not. But I'd just say, if every step in the process has this interaction with the public, you don't get the review I was thinking you were asking for.
And in some ways, we're looking for that sort of input from the team as to how you think peer review of the scientific portions of this document should occur. So that's maybe that starts the discussion.
So Linwood, and then
I just wanted to point out in the TMDL reviews that I'm working on, there are two separate kinds of reviews. There's the scientific review, which is much like a journal review, and there's the policy review, which is much more focused on process. Mm-hmm. That was, were the processes followed? Was it transparent? Mm-hmm. Were the ground rules adhered to? And so that latter kind I'm doing is very public, and you know, it's me working with a lot of people. I mean, it wouldn't be appropriate for that to be anonymous necessarily. But the scientific part, maybe. So we may want to think of this as a bipartite type of review process.
Steve,
so far, when we've been drafting documents or parts of documents, we've been doing it at a fairly conversational level of language. A scientific review demands not only good language, but it also demands to know where your sources are and how you know those things. Mm-hmm. So far we haven't been paying too much attention about doing that or putting in the technical detail to these documents that would really facilitate a true scientific review. So I guess my question is, that is what you need, though, isn't it? And are we then going to have to look forward to creating separate sections in this framework document that will provide the kind of information that a scientific review would be able to review?
Can I, in a way, this is the process, and it's all videotaped for anybody to watch, so maybe.
No, but I was thinking when I was reading Steve's guidance that whenever you had numbers, if you just had a couple of footnotes or references, even beyond the review process, it would just help the Blue Ribbon Task Force to know whether these were numbers that you made up, or whether they came from someplace else. So I think it's a good idea.
The numbers, you can make up the references.
You could.
But you wouldn't.
I think it comes back to something Rick Starr brought up right after our first meeting, that he was feeling a little uncomfortable about just expressing judgments without having the scientific data available to support those judgments.
Right. So we get into a call for where you want that to go.
And I think we're not looking for a complete scientific treatise on the design of MPAs. However, I think Linwood's comment is valid, that it probably would strengthen this document to have some appropriate references added to those sections that you've provided us. And I think part of why we went for the very informal conversational part right now is we were under a tight timeline. At that point, we're still under a tight timeline. But now that we've discussed it further, I think you might be able to give us some of those appropriate references where needed in that section and add that to it for the background, not only for scientific review, but as Linwood mentions, for the public and task force as well. It's nice to see those papers are there. And in some cases, people actually do go and read them to see where the data is coming from.
Yeah, I think that in a situation like this, that it's so complicated that if you restricted yourself to sort of the scientific paper standard, it would just shut us down. We couldn't help the task force.
Right. So that's where I'm asking for advice about where to hit the balance.
Yeah.
If we're especially going to be revising this design document.
I mean,
we'll try. I think the best thing to do is to ramp it up.
ramp it up a bit.
And when we get it to a point where you think that'll probably match your idea of the kind of review you're going to need, let us know.
Yeah, I think a couple of things here. One, first, I will confess and apologize for having not given you a heads up on this earlier. I didn't understand that the master plan framework, per se, was going to have a peer review until very recently. And I understood the peer review process was going to take place at various places. It just didn't hit my head, and maybe it hit other people's heads, but we didn't get it conveyed expressly. In any case, I think there is a tension between how much detailed citation we want in the master plan framework, which is a general planning guidance type document, and what's available for the peer review. I think some adding of citations in is right now is perfectly appropriate, and I think we will complete the master plan framework, take it to the task force on April 11th. We can continue to add in more citation type stuff before it goes to the peer review. But begin to add some of that in, that's good now. And then if necessary, we'll add some more in as we move forward.
So when you do revisions to these sections, as we talked about this morning, I'd say add some of the clear and obvious papers that you're drawing from. Mm-hmm. But you're not doing a huge literature search to come up with the bulk.
And just to close the conversation, I can't tell whether we have post lunch sugar lows or whether this is oh my god what the hell is going on or boredom or what. But Astrid has a question. I'm sorry.
I've had my card up.
Well, I wasn't. Yeah. I
There's
apologize.
There's two cards up. There are cards up. No, post lunch coma. A couple of things. I, having been at the receiving end of some of these sort of ad hoc review type panels, one thing that's been really helpful is to actually meet face to face with reviewers. I would like a process whereby some of the recommendations we come up with, maybe even the framework document in toto, is read by an outside group of scientists and experts who come back to us with some hard questions and then meet with us perhaps. And over the course of a half-day conversation, convince themselves that, yeah, we've given it our best shot, whether it's adequate documentation or best expert judgment. In some of these instances, the line, frankly, blurs. And the way I understood our charter is very much a case of being willing to stick your neck out a little bit on your best considered judgment. If you waited for everything to be, showing up in the published literature, you would never get this MLPA implemented, right? So I'd like the review process to reflect that, and then maybe some interactive process could be instigated there. Kind of like it's going to make me think of my dissertation defense, but rather than the totally anonymous, you send something off to a bunch of reviewers and you get back the scathing reviews. Something more interactive, perhaps. With regard to John's question about particular sections of the framework document that would lend themselves to review, I think I concur with your suggestions. Sections 2 and 5 stick out particularly as reviewable items, but I would also submit the couple of the appendices really ought to be reviewed. In particular, Appendix B, the list of species, and the not yet at all fleshed out Appendix G, that I have some concerns about from the socioeconomic perspective, because there's a lot of reference being made to stakeholder and interested public participation, and there's sort of an undercurrent that a lot of information will be gathered through that avenue. And that's problematic from a social science perspective, because not every social science research project involves stakeholder groups or focus groups. And I can talk about that a little bit more if we get around to my presentation. And so the way that this Appendix G, the strategy gets formulated, and then the expectations vis-a-vis information gathering that are attached to it actually becomes quite critical for the socioeconomic perspective of and considerations in the master plan. And so that's certainly something I would like to see reviewed.
Okay, well, I just was going to see if there was general closure, and that's very helpful, Astrid, because I had not paid as much attention to the appendices, so that's very helpful. And people agree that if we were to do the review, that two and five go together, pretty obviously. And then the other question is, if we choose to do a review on management enforcement, it would be a different sort of competencies. Mm-hmm. That's general agreement? Okay.
Yeah.
We'll work on that. We'll come back with a...
As a comment to that, two and five go together, but they involve different expertises.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Again, to sort of reiterate Jeff Padwan's point, if you constitute a panel mm-hmm. of people with various expertise, that's how you're going to get your best review.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and this definitely would be a panel.
Looks like the glossary 2, Appendix A, would be useful for some peer review. And I just also wanted to think about the different perspectives from having something that's more of an open process peer review for some of these sections and the types of comments we might get back for something of more of the traditional peer review, sort of a closed. I think that a lot of the reviews that you might get might be flavored by whether it's sort of an open process or an anonymous process, and I think that's something that we should probably think about, which sections might benefit more from what types, that Linwood's suggestion of maybe having a mixed model there of which types of reviews might be appropriate for which sections. So that would be something we could think about as well.
Okay. Any other burning?
Just a point of clarification. Esther, did you mean H or G? H is the one about stakeholders and public participation, whereas G, in my copy, says summary of recent ongoing processes.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right.
H.
Wait, yes, you're right. H.
H is the Marine Life Protection Act.
Oh, you know,
G is the strategy for stakeholder involvement.
Okay, I'm reading revised MPF appendices version 0405. Mark.
Yeah, you know what? In the contents of the appendix, it says H, strategy for stakeholder and interested public participation.
Nice.
And then when you go into the document,
okay.
Oh no, wait a minute.
I'm
no, it's H.
No,
page 41.
No, it's not.
It's a stakeholder document. In any case, we can figure it out.
Well, in my version, it is Appendix H. So
I see. You're right. So something got added to one of these that we didn't catch in one appendix. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Huh, isn't that interesting?
Oh, it's the new E.
Yeah. There you go. See?
Good catch.
Okay. All right. And we're closing that topic. And again, I'd recommend reading the OMB paper. It's an interesting paper just in the context of the whole political science debate currently underway. But,
careful what you say.
Global warming and so on and so on. Enough said. Okay, now we're taking action to remedy the imbalance between natural science and social science. So,
no, we're not. Not unless there are another 15 of us on this.
So stay awake.
I don't know if you can bring up the presentation.
Okay. So Astrid.
Well, I just
30 minutes to correct the intro.
20 minutes.
Yeah, right. It's really just a quick walkthrough some of the pertinent socioeconomic concepts and themes. And actually, I'd like to refer you to page 38, I guess, of the master plan framework, where there is a very explicit reference to the question of consulting local communities, collecting practical information on the marine environment and the relevant history of fishing and other resource use, areas where fishing is currently prohibited, etc. And then point two here is socioeconomic and environmental impacts. So it's clearly playing, it's supposed to play an important role. And as I pointed out before, this Appendix G, this piece about, you know, the strategy of how we're going to involve stakeholders and the interested public seems to make an assumption about how information will be brought to the MLPA process, and that and some of our past discussions of Linwood's and my and soon to be Dick Young's attempts at sort of creating a parallel line of reasoning in our design criteria, et cetera, have prompted me to just pull together a bunch of slides to really just refresh our collective memory. I'm sure you've all seen versions of this. We can have the next slide, please. This is from Kerry Pomeroy, who's done several very interesting presentations on just this very theme, what social science is not. It's not policy, and thanks to John and others who keep reminding us that we're scientists here and we're not charged with doing the policy work. But there's sometimes a temptation to mistake the social in social science for a particular penchant or strength even in crafting policy. And I certainly speak for myself, and I'm probably speaking for Linwood in saying that that's not our function here either, or of our expertise. Neither is politics a role or the purview of social science. We don't dabble in political opinion, principles, or party connections, or conduct on participation in political affairs. Again, there might be a perception that, oh, we have to have social scientists on the science team to appease stakeholders. If that's our intended political role, that's not something we can provide, and that's not the function of social science. And again, you won't get many prescriptions out of us, much like the natural scientists. We can have the next slide. Now, what it is, social science, and this goes directly to the point of how we imagine we will involve stakeholders and the interested public, it is the study of human interaction, culture, and social organization, production, consumption of goods, etc. And we use a variety of theory, data collection, and analysis to describe, explain, and predict. Now, when I see this language in here about a strategy for involving stakeholders, it concerns me a little bit because it seems to suggest that there's a particular way in which the process or the initiative imagines that socioeconomic information will be brought to the process. And if you let me attempt an analogy, it's a bit like telling Rick Kavitek, oh, please tell me about benthic habitats, but you can only use submarines, right? It's sort of prescribing the research mode. But not everything social scientists do, not every research mode is group-based or even focus group-based or expert witness-based. And so we need to be careful that we don't conflate the need and desire for socioeconomic information with a particular mechanism, especially one that is largely politically motivated, because it goes sort of it's at odds with what social science is and does and can do. Next slide, please. And then I have to make just a small dig at economists. We're sort of a special breed among the social scientists. By and large, we treat marine resources like money in the bank. A lot of what we can provide are attempts at valuing or ocean resources, and that takes several forms. If I can have the next slide. By and large, you will find us talking about the different, hopefully one thing we can bring to this science panel is an understanding of the total economic value of marine resources. And there's a large body of economic theory about these different values and how to measure them. And it gets more difficult the more removed you are from people's immediate self-interest. Not surprisingly, in a stakeholder political process, there's a lot of interest in the direct uses and the consumptive values in particular, where it hits people in the pocketbook, whatever action this process ends up taking. And that's certainly where people like Linwood and myself would expect to provide some expertise around the quantification of these direct use values, both on the consumptive and non-consumptive side. And there are techniques and mechanisms, some of which are quite challenging, in the marine environment, and you'll hear us griping about the sort of general dearth of data and analysis, unlike our colleagues in the biological and ecological sciences that can fall back on a much richer tradition and history of existing research. There are other considerations that may or may not become pertinent. I just wanted to put it up there, this universe of values. indirect uses of marine resources, the sort of ecological support provided to fisheries and other ecosystem services. There are techniques for getting at those, and I haven't, you know, we haven't. I don't want to preclude any of those techniques if they become of interest to the process. And we can go down the line into, you know, it becomes less and less tangible. But given that it's a public policy process, some of these will need to be considered on the far right there, in the non-use values. Existence values are notoriously hard to describe, but are very, very relevant to a public policy decision down the line. And we can help with some of that. If I can have the next slide, please. You're all familiar with the consumptive uses that tend to concern us when we're talking about the designation of marine protected areas. But bear in mind, that's really only one sliver of the total economic value of the resources out there. And we have an okay understanding of commercial and recreational fishing activities in California. Diving is much less well understood from an economic theory perspective. And then it gets really, really complicated in the non-consumptive uses. And I don't want to create the impression that that we have a lot of answers. And partly I was hedging in the scientific review discussion, because we will be really hard-pressed to give you a lot of peer-reviewed studies to help get at some of these non-consumptive values in particular. And it doesn't make them any less important, but some of them are much less well articulated and specified in California and elsewhere. And Linwood and some of his colleagues are just getting underway on a big non-consumptive use valuation study that will hopefully shed some light on the MLPA process as well. If I could have the next slide. It's not too much more, just a couple of random, well, not quite random, but select comments on research methods in social sciences. Not every interview is with a stakeholder. Not everything we do is even interviews. Not every focus group involves stakeholders. There are very distinct uses of these techniques and modes of research, and I again want to caution in this process that we don't inadvertently, through some of the policy-influenced language, end up prescribing a socioeconomic research strategy. And Linwood and I and Dick will look out for those kinds of pitfalls. Similarly, not every analysis that we can do is an impact assessment. There's a lot of emphasis in the framework document on the socioeconomic impacts, and I pointed out earlier that impacts can be both negative and positive, and it goes directly to this distinction between consumptive and non-consumptive users. One person's favorite dive spot is another person's best fishing hole. And if you're precluding somebody from going fishing there, then my benefit as a diver just increased because I'm not going to run into some fishing line. Right? I've just experienced a positive impact the same time as you've experienced a negative impact. And balancing these two and capturing all these facets of impacts is going to be very challenging. But that said, not everything we do is an impact assessment. And I understand from a regulatory perspective, you have to consider the impacts. But there's also a whole range of other socioeconomic analysis that is relevant that I would like us to keep in mind, sort of in parallel with the natural science. Not every data collection instrument is a survey, and not every survey is quantitative. We do plenty of quantitative surveys, and there might be a role for them in this process, for all I know. There may be other forms of eliciting qualitative information, and I want to caution against this notion that qualitative or ethnographic information is anecdotal. These are just some of the common misperceptions I've come across in my work on the coast, and so I just want to caution against going down a particular stakeholder process, assuming that they will provide all the socioeconomic information that's relevant to our process, or that by virtue of being a qualitative process, it can be discounted as anecdotal. So there are many, many facets to this story. And I think what's going to be my last slide or two, I want to highlight some of the non-fishing activities out there. And I realize we're charged through the MLPA, there is an explicit recognition of encouraging recreational and educational uses and so on and so forth. And by and large, our discussion, even from the scientific perspective, has been focused on prohibiting consumptive uses, fishing in particular. But I want us to, just want to put out a few statistics here on what some of these other uses look like to give us a flavor for the size and shape of the issue, really. Marine recreation, in particular, is huge in the U.S. Some 89 million participants in the last wave of the National Survey on Recreation and the Environment. California is the number two destination with over 17 million participants coming here, both from in and out of state. And the top activities are things like swimming, photography, and fishing. And if you go to the final slide, you'll see that fishing is actually a distant sixth in terms of participation rate. And what's really interesting to me, and sort of in terms of a potential major research gap that we're facing from the socioeconomic perspective, is getting a good handle at some of these highly popular activities like photography. And this is literally photography in saltwater environments. That's how specific the survey question was. So these are people that recreate by taking pictures on water, or in watery environments anyway. And there's a lot of them spending a lot of days per activity days in California that translate from an economic perspective into multiplier effects, impacts, and whatnot. And I think as part of a statewide process, we will have to consider some of these activity types, including in how we interact with stakeholders and including in the kind of socioeconomic information that we're trying to bring to bear. So I don't want us to just get distracted or focused on the far left-hand side of the total economic value equation. So with that, thanks. And we'll be sure to remind you of the socioeconomic dimensions as we proceed, too. Okay.
Yeah. John.
That was very helpful. Thank you. And before you read the stakeholder strategy and flip,
care to revise it?
It is not actually doing what it says in these two paragraphs at all.
Good.
And frankly, what I would like to ask of you and maybe Linwood and maybe Richard Young also is if you could come up with a paragraph or two that describe the various techniques to gather the information in number one and number two there, that would be a great addition to this framework. What the strategy for stakeholder and interested public participation process is exactly that. It's for how people participate in the process, mm-hmm. not how we gather information from those people. Right. So it is a very different tool.
Right, and Linwood and I have sort of an ongoing conversation with the MLPA initiative staff about a socioeconomic research strategy to accompany the process.
Well, even sort of more general than a strategy, just a description of the various techniques would be really helpful, I think, in the document.
What is one and two that you're referring to?
Oh, she was referring to on page 38. There's two items in the Act that specifically talk about information about how people use the environment. And the problem is the strategy for stakeholder and interested public participation follows right after that and kind of makes you think that that's how you're gathering number one and two,
right.
But it's really not. And in fact, the way it's written makes it seem like that. And so it's a good catch as far as editing goes. And I would suggest that we add two or three paragraphs or however many you can come up with right after that number one and two there to talk about how you collect those type of data. That'd be helpful.
Right. Yeah, there's sort of there's a couple of times, I guess, even in the activity, in the long list of activities in that table, there's sort of an the parallel structure that I think some of us would like to see isn't always made explicit, and so you end up falling into this assumption that the objectives and goals are ecologically motivated, and then the socioeconomic impacts are secondary as part of the
any
regulatory
comments
review.
You can provide, I mean, even just track changes comments to the document that help fix that would be great.
Sure.
I mean, that's exactly what we need from your end of it at this point, is making sure that the framework adequately describes how socioeconomic information is coming into the process and when. Because I do think we discussed a little over lunch that it shouldn't be a socioeconomic analysis of impacts after the design. It should be a part of the design.
Okay. Any questions? Brastard? It'd be better if we just move along. We have an item on the agenda also in organizational issues to talk about the interaction between the science advisory team and the task force. Have we covered that pretty much, or are there other burning questions? I think it'll evolve, and please bring it up if there's confusion so we can deal with it at the meetings. It's a lot easier to deal with those things here in the meeting than it is to deal outside. So, okay. Yeah, I think we can take 20 minutes and come back to the information item on the agenda. And if we could take 20 minutes, and I think Laura has put together a presentation on GIS. And I think this is intended just to put a stake in the ground so we can start a dialogue.
Sub-team organized, and we just want to give a brief report on some of the things that we've been thinking of. The sub-team was Rick Kvitek, myself, Astrid, and we had some input from Rick Starr. What we want to do is get an initial feel from the team about what kinds of things would be useful for this MLPA process. And I think Astrid's discussion just now about what it is that we do as scientists, we collect data and we try and use those data to talk about natural systems, socioeconomic systems. And in this case, we're trying to use data that are out there to help inform the MLPA process. So I think one of the things in my mind as I'm beginning to settle into the team and figure out how it is that this team can contribute to the MLPA process best is I'm beginning to think that the databases that we bring together as a group that we all identify and think are relevant, I think that would be one thing that could be really helpful. We're really good at answering questions about specific things. Are there bigger rockfish here than there? Are there more divers here than there? And those are the kinds of things that these kinds of databases, I think, will be useful for. So I've gotten some help from our GIS group, Mira, Paolo, and Gina, who have been working with Rick for a while. And Rick was supposed to be out in the ocean today, but it's so nasty that he's here with us, which will be really helpful. So why don't we go on to the next slide. So what we want to do is we want to query the team and see what kinds of databases will be most useful for this process. And I think that we all have a sense that spatially explicit data is going to be very useful for this process, and GIS is the way most of us visualize these spatially explicit data. We want to make sure that they're collected at a scale that's going to be relevant for the process. We just had a discussion today about biogeographic provinces probably being much too large to be relevant for the process, and there may be data that we collect that are at too fine a scale. So that's something we want to talk about. Okay. One of the critical things that I would like to throw out to this whole team is in your area of specialization, and I think we've got a really well-balanced team, a real dream team here. What we would like is for everyone to be thinking about what kinds of data exist and what would be most useful for the process, and maybe at the same time thinking ahead about what data gaps exist. So I know that the socioeconomics groups have been thinking about what kinds of gaps might need to be filled, and I think we could all start thinking about that, okay? Then we also want to think about if we had all the data on the table, we all came with mobile external hard drives, we had all the data that we wanted, we would like to start thinking about a process for the delivery and storage of these data in a way that are going to be open and accessible. This is the desire for this process to be an open process. We would like it so that it's open so that a lot of members of this science advisory team can have access to it as well as others. And we'd like to know how that delivery system might take place. And we'd like to look at the types of servers that are around that maybe will be able to provide some of the functions that we want, being queryable, things like some of the live access servers. So I've asked Gina to start talking about some of these, but as she gets started with what some of those are, I'd like to put an example up on the overhead.
Okay.
This is from Rick Kvitek's group, and they've looked at subtitle mapping. So this is a high-resolution multi-beam bathymetry map along the Big Sur coastline. It's a spot at Yankee Point. And the nice thing about this image here that he's done by this multi-beam work is you can really see clearly the rocky reef structures here and then the soft sediment structures here. It takes very little interpretation by skilled geologists. It just comes out right up at you. You can see the relief there. So these are the kinds of data that will be useful in this process. And we can talk about geodatabases and how they get structured.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about the key points of a geodatabase. Geodatabases are kind of like a storage container for storing spatial attribute data, attribute data being tabular data, you know, spreadsheets, Word files, and whatnot, and the relationships that exist among between them. The different types of spatial data and tabular data exist together in this cohesive storage system of the geodatabase. And the different types of data that can exist in this storage geodatabase system are the different types that we have, or vector, which are like points, port information, line or coastline files, and polygons, which would be a marine protected area. We also store raster data. Multi-beam imagery would be an example of that, and navigational charts, and aerial imagery. Tabular data, like I just mentioned, was the spreadsheets data. You could have access database information and whatnot put into it, which would have fisheries data related to that, or ROV survey transects. And the rules and relationships can be defined in this geodatabase system to help organize and create a complex data model, which is helped organized by the geodatabase model itself. And the data can be delivered using an internet map server. So this data could actually, once it's put in the geodatabase, can be served off of a server to the public and the members and anybody interested in gathering the information. If people have questions, you can reference them. Go to the IMS server at this location. The data is there. You can check it out for yourself. And this complements existing marine data models, so we're not reinventing the wheel. We are just going through and populating an existing model with data that the group would choose to use. This is a feature classes for a geodatabase, the points, lines, and areas, and rasters. This is the structure of how the data would fall into a geodatabase model. You can see I gave examples of points, lines, and areas, and rasters already. This is just in a chart to illustrate that visually. This is a cartoon of data acquisition that which fits into the geodatabase model. And the science team here will decide ultimately, if they so choose to do a geodatabase, what data that will reside in the geodatabase model itself. So this is just an example of how some data is collected and how what types of data would be put into this particular example. But the example for this team would be look quite differently, depending on the data that the team chooses to use. And this is a slide showing a couple data sets as samples that we would use to populate the geodatabase model. And right now I'm going to toggle and go back to the GIS and do a live presentation on examples of these data layers. So on the visual you see here, I have examples of different types of data that I just showed on the slide. For the 3 nautical mile state limit is shown here in the red. So shoreline out to the red is the state waters limit. We wanted to show a data set of kelp. You can see the kelp, persistence kelp of 2002 is showed right here in the green shade. We have bathymetry based off of multi-beam data collected by Kivitec, shown right here off of Point Pinos in the Monterey Bay area. And on top of that, which you barely can see, are the contour lines, which were a product of the multi-beam data. So those are just briefly a few of the data sets that we could incorporate into a geodatabase. And we have marine protected areas, which are shown in the little crosshatched here. Ultimately, whatever the science team chooses to decide to use, we have fisheries data that we could populate into this database. And pretty much it's ultimately up to the team to decide what they want to be into this database. Oh, sorry, before I go back. Yeah, these are fishing blocks populated with fisheries data. Yes, this is the 99 to 2004 CPFV Caltrol count blocks of catch. Actually, this is just persistent, how much catch was caught per block for that five-year period. So the beige is 2 to 5 counts per that block, and then as it increases with color, the green is 6 to 12, turquoise is 13 to 22, then up to the blue, which is 35 to 49. So actually, my screen colors look much different than what's shown up on the wall. Sorry. The beige is this would be beige on my screen, is lowest count to the highest count would be the dark blue right here. Okay, I can run through more data if people want to do that after the meeting, but just to get back to the presentation quickly. So that's where we left off, and now we're going to talk about the status of an enterprise geodatabase, which I really didn't go into detail what an enterprise geodatabase is. It's just a geodatabase that is served on a server to the public or whoever has access to that versus a personal geodatabase, which is a private geodatabase that each individual would have on their own machine.
And we're going to open it up for Steve Gaines to talk about this slide, although this is the first he's heard of it. This is about the enterprise geodatabase type work that they are just starting now at UC Santa Barbara, and they're starting to work with our GIS lab in the state to look at the data sets that the state has and see if they might not be able to serve those on their enterprise geo database. Is that right, Steve? Briefly.
Actually, there's quite a bit of data that are already in the database.
Oh, great.
They're not just served to the public yet.
Okay.
But yeah, no, there's been a lot of work going on, and quite a bit of the fish and game data are already in there. Oh, sorry. So there, there's, it's up and running. A lot of the stuff is now privately accessible that's in there already. Matter of what wants to be made public. That always becomes an issue with some types of data.
Mm-hmm.
Not governmental data, but other kinds of data becomes a serious issue when it's coming out of someone's personal lab. You have to always deal with those kinds of things. But that's and so the infrastructure there in terms of the hardware is ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a problem. We're happy to support it through the process.
Okay. So this is one example of an enterprise geodatabase project that's going on now, and you know, we as a team can look at that pilot project and see how that is operating. And at the bottom of this slide, I put down other options, because of course there are other options, live access servers, and those kinds of things that are very appealing for certain kinds of data, and being used, for example, Cal Coffee is down in Southern California Bight area starting to put up a lot of their data onto a live access server, and there are a lot of other models for serving these kinds of data for the process that we should be looking at. So what we wanted to do in this talk was to the sub-team wants to query this group and see what the options are and where we want to go, because the next slide starts to talk about the use of some of these data in decisions support tools for MPA processes. So a lot of you in this room have been involved in the Channel Islands process, where some of these GIS-based decision support tools have been used. There's a couple of papers out on these topics, and they've been used in MPA processes on the Great Barrier Reef. And, of course, the idea behind these different support tools is that you are selecting to maximize certain things. Maybe you want to maximize biodiversity hotspots and minimize area. So these are user-specified criteria that you are trying to maximize, in some cases with algorithms, and in other cases they do it in different ways. But these are the kinds of tools that have been used in these processes, and ideally we'd like to have these, whatever we select, be able to fit into whatever kind of support tool we want. And I know Astrid's been looking in at OceanMap and developing that for EcoTrust, and you probably have a lot of information for us on those. And a lot of other folks in this room have worked on these things more, but I think these are the kinds of things that we need to be thinking about and moving head on with the short time frames that we're working under. Astrid?
Yeah, I want to clarify a couple of things. One is just the word tool can be misleading. It generates this impression that there's something that is, you know, ready, off the shelf, ready to go. And that's typically not the case for any of these. MarkSan, SpecSan is really an algorithm. It's simulated annealing. It's a technique that has been packaged in several different applications and it runs on objective functions that one has to define that are specific to a particular goal. So I would not recommend that we just take whatever they used in the Channel Islands and now use it statewide, right? I mean, we have our own set of objectives, et cetera. So it's important to distinguish that. Similarly, OceanMap is something that Environmental Defense developed, and it's sort of a public access or a public open source software now. They're distributing it quite freely. It's best thought of as an interface for collecting information in polygon in a polygon format. So you can literally draw shapes and collect new spatially explicit information. And what's nice about it is that you can program a bunch of pull-down menus to customize whatever information you're collecting. So we have used it, albeit not in the Channel Islands. That's just it's factual inaccuracy on the slide. We've used it in the in Cordell Bank and the Gulf of the Farallones. We've tailored the interface to a particular survey instrument that we used with the fishing working groups up there to collect information on their fishing grounds, which we have then used in our own back-end application that has a different name, yet again, to run some spatial analysis on fishing use patterns and intensity and identifying fishing hotspots and constraining the Department of Fish and Game landing receipts. And that analysis is forthcoming. It's under a departmental review right now. The habitat suitability modeling is sort of a finished product in the sense that it's a finished analysis using GIS, and it's spatially explicit. But I wouldn't describe it as a tool. It's really, at this point, I mean, if you buy into their approach and their methodology and their findings, then effectively it becomes a data layer that we may want to consider, because it's the end product is a set of habitat suitability indices assigned to particular areas that we can then overlay and compare to, bathymetric features or whatever else we choose to do. So just a couple of clarifications there.
Mm-hmm. So I think this is a sample of some of the things that have been used to support MPA processes and the types of things that we could do, and I think what I'd like to suggest is that I see one of the roles that the science team can play is to bring some data to bear to some of these questions, and the way that we do that is really open and up to us, whether we go and modify something that's already been used, whether we develop things to suit our own applications. You know, it's going to depend on time and people, and so I just like to get us thinking in these directions.
Yeah, thank you, Laura, for getting this and get us started on this. So, and maybe at the next meeting we could focus on just what are some of the key decisions that we're going to need to make.
So okay.
Good lead time. Thank you. You have one comment?
Yes.
You've dominated this.
Yeah, sorry. I head up a department called Knowledge Systems at EcoTrust, so this is sort of my bread and butter in addition to the economics. One thing that's become apparent in our work and a role that I would urge us to take on as a science advisory team is the issue of data quality with geographic information systems, and how to convey that to the public and to stakeholders. There's a great book out, How to Lie with Maps. And there's nothing more disconcerting than collecting a bunch of heterogeneous information of varying quality into a geodatabase, and the maps that come out sort of create this sense, this false democracy of quality. And it's actually not a trivial issue of how you convey even the number of data sets that went into a map, or your degree of confidence in them. And they're both, simple ways out and more involved statistical ways out to capture that. And I think that would be an adequate role, a very appropriate role for us to play, to come up with some sort of measure of data quality, or some metric of data quality that goes into any of these decision support tools and GIS layers that end up being used in the process.
Okay, we had one.
Maybe we could make an action item for folks to start thinking about data sets that they think would be useful for this process, and also the description of the metadata that would go along with those.
Yeah, it's not just metadata. Metadata typically refer to one data source, but what happens when you combine a couple of or several data sets into a composite map?
Well, let's get first we need to, I think, start with what data sets we want to even think about. Maybe we don't want to think about any data sets, but if there are some that we think would be valuable for this process, we should bring them to the next meeting. You know, not physically, but so I'd like to make that an action item for Gary to
think about,
to type up, and for folks to think about.
I'm just thinking about it all the time.
Yeah, first I'd like to thank Laura, Gina, and Mira for putting that together. I had absolutely nothing to do with it. Great job, guys. thanks for putting my name on it. But there's a caution and a recommendation, and one is I always recommend thinking top-down when you're doing GIS rather than bottom-up. That is, you don't want to make a data pile, just collecting everything that you can think of that might have some spatial relationship to the area. And that's why I think that the work that the subgroup of this morning, you guys putting together guidelines for networks, is one great place to start, because to fulfill those needs, what sort of data information is going to be required to do that, and then use that to guide your thinking in terms of the sort of data that should be brought to bear, rather than just, how many minnows lived in such and such a. But anyway, so if we can organize ourselves in terms of thinking of the data needs related to our actual goals first.
Okay. Yeah. Top down. Yeah. Okay. Steve Murray. This has to be
the MLPA, has a clear section which I think we're really working hard to address, which is to not only build social science into the process, but to minimize socioeconomic impact in whatever models are offered, alternative models are offered. And obviously one of the major areas to look in that regard is with regard to fishing. And I know that in the last process we were involved with, we tried to look very hard at the fishing data that were available in order to try to build those into modifications we were making in our designs. But the fishing data that we were able to look at were mismatches with regard to the scale of the MPA designs we were working with. And I was wondering whether we might get some thought or advice about, first, what kind of fishing data are needed to really move forward in this endeavor, and two, do we have any access to the data at the scale appropriate to the task?
We don't want to discuss it.
But it's going top down, but starting with what kind of estimates do we need to make on fishing, and then what data.
And maybe I'll work with Astrid to get something for the next meeting that describes tools we can use to refine the fishing block data, and that would be a good next meeting presentation that maybe Astrid can give.
Okay, thank you, everybody, for doing that. Okay,
Mark A.
Oh, you were up and then went. I thought you were done. Okay.
But on a different topic, if that's acceptable.
Well, tell us the topic. And then.
study regions, something that we've kind of studiously avoided today. But you and I had a long conversation by phone last week. John and I had a short conversation in La Jolla last week. And I think it would be beneficial for us all to hear the answer. Well, at least I would like to hear the answer to my question about, after an initial study region is selected for the Central Coast area, on what time frame will other study regions be selected, study region number two? And will that study region be in the Southern California domain or Northern California domain, I mean outside the Central Coast area? Or is there the intent to return to the rest of the Central Coast? And my larger question is, if a study region is selected in the near term, is that going to be the near-term and medium-term focus for the MLPA efforts? Or is, as I think you implied to me, Steve, that all of the coast would eventually be covered?
Start with your last, yes, all of the coast will eventually be covered, and all of the coast will be covered by 2011. So your time frame for the entire ball of wax is 06 to 11 for completing the rest of the study regions. When will the next study region occur after the Central Coast study region, immediately following it, most likely? That hasn't been specifically stated, but in order to complete the entire coast by 2011, I would suspect that's necessary. I think you heard John Kerlin mention today in one of his discussions that in looking at the size of the first study region that's selected, you can get a feel for how many additional study regions there would have to be, and it's on the order of five-ish, I think. Total,
five or six,
yeah, depending on how you look at it. And whether that will be Central Coast, North Coast, South Coast, that really has not been discussed at all. And I think if there's some scientific input on what area needs it the most, we'd love to hear it from you all and as we move forward. If it's my impression that much of that decision will be political, however, again, you may have scientific input that this area receives the highest level of use or this area has the highest level of existing science or et cetera that help you decide what to do next. But that hopefully that answers most of your question to the extent that I can.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does. And it's encouraging to me to know that the entire coast of California will go through this process by 2011. Yeah.
That is specified in the MOU between the department and the agency and the outside partners.
My second quick point is regarding my email request that the science advisory team provide their input on species, habitats, ecosystems, archaeological sites, et cetera, and that I would like to know whether that's something that we can move forward with.
Yeah, it needs to be done. It's when do we do it, I guess. And when
it seems to me that if we do it sooner rather than later, it right. will make some of the other part of the yeah. process that we need to do easier.
Okay. I need to understand, or we need to understand what the task, nature of the task is and how it ties to the Central Coast project to make it meaningful, and I think if we're going to put the energy into it, it's important to set it up and do it right and get complete participation. So can we start it at this meeting? I don't think so.
I don't think so either, yeah. but I hope we can agree to start it soon.
Okay, we agree. I agree.
And maybe we'll appoint Mark as the head of that sub-team, and he will work with you, Steve, to make it happen between now and the next meeting, or start the process between now and the next meeting.
Is that okay? This is a great learning moment in terms of framing. Mark thought that if we picked a certain section of the between Conception and Point Arena, that only that part of that area would be considered, and the rest would never have marine reserves. Just a different way of perceiving what the decision was.
The political will and the money would dry up before we got there.
Maybe that's a different issue, but At the same time, an important person at the Pacific Fishery Management Council thought that by choosing that study region, we were designating the whole thing as a marine reserve. So, different frames. It's true. Okay. We have one thing we need to do. Decide if we have the next meeting on April 21st.
And if not, when do we
if
have,
not, when do we have our next meeting?
I have a day job, and I teach on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays, so the 21st is a Thursday, so I'm out anyway.
And that meeting was put on, as you remember, at our last meeting, as somewhat of a placeholder in the case that we felt another meeting prior to the master plan framework being delivered to the commission was necessary. From the quality of the discussion today and the quality of the sub-team work, I get the impression that we don't need to have that meeting. And we have already over-meeting you based on our original, when I called all of you and talked about the commitment, we said meetings approximately every other month, and I think we've done one a month for the past 3 months. So my proposal would be that we skip the April meeting and we find a date after April for your next meeting, at which time we'll know the Central Coast region. We will have a document that's either just about to go to the commission for their review or had just gone to the commission. Timing-wise, mid-May is a time that could be potential. Maybe let's start with that and see what people's schedules look like.
Friday the 13th.
Friday. I really hope that I am participating in the department diving certification that I'm supposed to teach every year, and I don't get to go too much anymore that week. So.
It's my wife's birthday. We can't do that.
Steve's wife's birthday. So. I was thinking sometime during the week of the 16th. We just heard that, what was it, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, or Mondays?
Tuesday, Thursday, Friday.
Tuesday, Thursday, Friday are teaching days for you.
Monday, Wednesday, Friday.
Monday, Wednesday, Friday for you.
John, not that it matters a great deal, but that week there's the Federal Advisory Committee for MPAs is meeting in Maine.
In D.C. Oh, Maine.
So I'll be at that meeting, and I don't know whether other folks
let's,
who.
Let's look at an alternative week because there's the joint meeting with the task force and the commission is the 23rd of May in Sacramento, which you're all invited to attend if you're interested. That's where the draft framework will be presented to the commission formally. I don't know. There is the week of the 9th of May, or even going further if we pushed it all the way to the first week of June. That's about as far as I'd like to push it out into the future. I think that's pretty far off. Week of May 9th, are there bad dates in that week?
Not Monday.
Not Monday, okay. Tuesday the 10th, anybody can't make it? 1, 2, 3... Wednesday the 11th. You can't make it, or you're okay. Wednesday the 11th of May. Going once.
John.
Yep.
If that's in the middle of the Coastal Commission meeting at Stanford that week. If that's an issue.
Is that an issue for anybody here? Not for me. Do you guys take those meetings?
We're not scheduled to, but things change quickly.
Well, we get you first.
Yeah.
Sounds like Wednesday, May 11th here in Oakland. Okay. Thank you, guys. That was easy.
Thank you. There are two things I would like to do. One is get some feedback on the meeting. I'll send out an email, and if you'll just send me back, answer a couple questions, what worked, what didn't work. And then the other thing is if you could think about what kinds of things we should deal with at future meetings. But I'll deal with that on email so that we can leave a few minutes for public comment. What else do we need to cover before we go to public comment? Anything?
Earlier you remarked that today's meeting went pretty well because the sub-teams prepared so well. And so I would encourage you to keep refining your document delivery abilities to us to make that more streamlined and to provide us a little bit more guidance, because if you send us 300 pages without telling us exactly what you want to do, then we have to wade through and hope we get it right. I think we would have all benefited from maybe a two-page or three-page executive summary with us in mind of the OMB peer review rather than trying to read 45 pages of that. So, you know, just streamline that. Make sure that we're only getting one email or an email that says go to the website and download the documents at your leisure and give us a little bit more direction about where you want us to focus our energy.
Yeah, I apologize for all that confusion. And we'll work on the software, and also what you're saying is when you send us an email, prioritize the things that are attached and what you think. We'll do that. Any other burning suggestion?
If no suggestion, it's a question. So as we continue to revise this draft management plan with all the suggestions that came up earlier today, the process is the sub-teams will give it a shot, send it to you.
Straight to Mike.
Okay, and then Mike distributes it to the team in general?
Just send it to me, and I'll make sure we all get it.
And then does it
copy John?
Yeah, CC everybody.
Mike and...
But then does it get distributed to the rest of the team for their feedback?
I think in this case, what I'd like to see is if you as a sub-team feel like it's ready, I would say go ahead and go straight to the team with it first. And you as the sub-team leader coordinate that bit of response from this whole team. And, of course, we're working on short deadlines again, so please be prompt. And then you as the sub-team leader send it to this group to be sure we get it. Is that sensible? I'd rather do that to save the step of John or Steve getting it and then having to send it out and then send it back to you and all of that.
Is this? Are you you referring to the contributions we're supposed to have to you by the 30th of March?
Anything that got assigned today, yeah, let's use that way.
That's supposed to go out to everybody, feedback back, revised.
But again, assumption is that the sub-team prepares something that's nearly ready. If any member of the full team has some burning issue with it, they'll get with you and fix that issue and then get it to us. We understand that this is not a long time frame at all.
Can we get a clarification on what's due on the 25th versus the 30th, since those dates?
I think the only thing that we gave the 30th was the new thing.
Okay.
And the revisions of the sub-team reports are the 25th.
Damn.
If you need an extra day, let us know. The 25th is not a magic day. What's critical is that we get it to Mike and I in time that it can go into the final version.
So given that, what you just said, we can get a revised thing, I think, through the sub-team, and easily get it to them by the 25th.
to the full team.
Then get it to the full team by the 25th, but I can't get it to you by the 25th.
That's probably fine. You know, again, our deadline now is that we need to get a document to the public on the 4th, Mike?
That's correct.
Okay, on the 4th, which means we really do need it a couple days before that so we can look at it and incorporate the changes. Okay.
Okay.
We've been providing for public comment. If anybody's interested in speaking, we do ask that you limit your comments to things appropriate to the science team. If you have specific comments about the draft master plan framework, please provide those to staff, either in written form or other form. And if you have specific comments to the MLPA in general, this really isn't the appropriate venue for that. But if you have questions that you think the team could think about at a later date or input on today's meeting, we really do welcome it.
So I'm not quite sure under those guidelines whether I should comment or not. It'll be shorter to comment than to figure
as
it
long,
out.
As long as it isn't the breakwater to Point Lobo, so I'm fine with it.
Well, actually, it is. In the section on science advisor team advice on MPA networks, item number 8, I know that was commented on earlier this morning, but I wanted to express that I have some concerns about that paragraph, and I know that's going to be worked over again, so I'll comment in writing after I see the revision on that. And it may not be relevant to the science team, but later on, under the section of types of MPAs, I'm looking at the PDF file, so it's harder to follow. One of the paragraphs, after the state marine reserves, it describes the process by which marine life reserves will guide, I suppose would be the word, extraction, consumptive, and what kind of activities will occur with them. I have a general concern in the whole paragraph, so it kind of reads like the National Homeland Security Act, where it doesn't really say that certain activities will occur, but it sort of hedges its bet where certain activities could occur, and I'm talking about restricting recreation. And also, one particular sentence, maybe it's just a typo. It refers to non-consumptive, such activities as diving and scientific collection. I think that's more than an oxymoron. I don't think scientific collection is a non-extractive activity. So that's something you want to look at also. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Bob Osborne. I just wanted to make a couple of brief comments on the portion of the some of the items that went into the science from the science panel. I know we got a lot of differing views on what the Act requires and what the biological communities need in the way of protection. And there's many just constituencies out there that can be dramatically affected by how this process moves forward. One thing the constituencies all have in common is a strong desire for marine resources to be healthy and productive indefinitely. And so the science team plays an important role here in providing rationale and alternatives to various ways to go about and doing this, you know, getting the protection that everybody wants out there. And in some other processes, it kind of came out with very definite recommendations, without explanations, without alternatives, without much devil's advocacy going on as to what might be a better approach to it or another way to solve the problem or an explanation of the problem. It came more out in the form of a tool in search of a problem to fix as opposed to coming out more as here's the problem, here are the alternatives of how to go about fixing it, here's the pluses and minuses of each one of the choices. And so I think it might help to kind of think of it in the process in terms of having a budget that you don't know what it is yet, that you're going to be able to solve the problem, but you can bet that the budget's going to be a lot less than what you would hope it to be. And then design these processes from, you know, kind of a from a basis of priorities. And a couple of areas that have gone into the discussion so far by the science team that I'm still struggling with and I don't understand because maybe I'm not a scientist or whatever. But one of them is the concept of relating back to the laws and the objectives of the law. And namely, two of them are protection of habitat and protection of biodiversity. And linking back to those objectives, you know, what some of the things we want to do. And how. And I've heard, like, in trying to determine various geographic boundaries and stuff, for example, discussion of biological communities. And I'm not sure how biological communities are going to satisfy either of those goals, although there may be some really important stuff there. It would really be helpful if it was well explained. And another topic is networks of MPAs. When I think of, like, for example, a network of sales distribution centers, the idea is of that network is to take goods from the manufacturer and send them to the retail customer, but they don't interconnect with each other. And so as we look at networks of MPAs, what are the objectives of those networks to determine the design of those networks? And so I've heard, for example, larval dispersal will provide some way to regenerate an MPA that might have had an oil spill in it or something of that nature. And so there may be alternatives to that. Maybe give the larva a ride over there from some place. It doesn't necessarily have to get there by swimming. And so, you know, especially for an extraordinary event, maybe we need to get some there on a normal basis, which makes more sense maybe designing that, but then explaining it in those terms would really help a lot. And the last thing I wanted to say was, there are two more things. I said alternatives outside of MPAs. That's one thing that the fishermen keep on asking. He says, don't close us out of an area completely unless there isn't really another good alternative to achieve the same gain. And I think that's something that maybe this team could spend a little time in their deliberations to kind of flesh out a little bit in their recommendations. And then the last thing was on the master plan guidance. There was a few numbers thrown out in the master plan guidance I felt a little bit uncomfortable with. One was optimum size of reserves. And I was thinking that's apt to vary according to local objectives for MPAs. And so I think it's really good to have guidance out there, the things to consider for the local processes to do. And perhaps the recommendation in the master plan is probably, oh, here's a good medium point or something. But that, I don't know if that's the best kind of guidance to be giving, as opposed to saying, let's give these considerations consider these different things when you determine what the optimum size would be. And that's all. Thank you.
My name is Bill James. I'm a nearshore commercial fisherman. And briefly, because I know everybody wants to get on the road, but for future at agenda possibility, I'm having some difficulties with making comment on species that are likely to benefit from MPAs and the word biodiversity. And one of the things is in our task is we're supposed to develop an alternative for networks for MPAs. And in doing that, I've come up with some literature, and I would like to give out this one article to the science panel. And I'm sorry I don't have copies for every single person. But what I will do is I will read the title of it, and I would like to have some comment back, maybe not at this meeting, by the next meeting, And the title of it is Restored Top Carnivores as Detriments to Performance of Marine Protected Areas Intended for Fishery Sustainability, a Case Study with Red Abalones and Sea Otters. And while this is just about invertebrates, I'm going to segue into finfish briefly in a second. But if you read through and you look at the end, one of the conclusions is, quote, our data indicate that marine protected areas with sea otters restored as top-level carnivores cannot serve the dual purpose of biodiversity enhancement in abalone fishery conservation off California. In the restored case, abalones will be constrained by foraging sea otters to a small subset of available microhabitats and densities and size distributions probably inadequate for significant contributions to regional fishery sustainability, although adequate for population subsistence. And I would really like the team to be able to comment on that, if possible. And moving in a segue over to finfish, if we're restoring lingcod to their former levels in a marine protected area, and lingcod have a lower maturity rate or a faster maturity rate than other rockfish, and lingcod have a migration pattern into the nearshore. And I'm a nearshore commercial fisherman. I'm really concerned with this. If you have a great deal of lingcod coming in the wintertime to spawn and eating our nearshore rockfish, our nearshore rockfish are a little bit slower to reproduce than the lingcod. And you have this overabundance of top carnivores in the finfish, which are lingcod, coming into as prey for our nearshore finfish species. In the wintertime, our bait has a tendency of going out into deeper waters. So while in the shallow waters, what you have is just the rockfish left as prey. So I'm really wondering how are we getting to our biodiversity goal and still doing this other? I really need some guidance in there, because this article really is a little bit contrary to some of the things that we're doing. And while we're on a very fast timeline here, I need to be able to answer the questions and provide an alternative of networks. And so I really need a list of species. With that in mind, what I just said that might benefit from MPAs, so I can develop an alternative to some of the things that might be to offer a substantive addition to this process. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much. Is there any questions?
If there are no other issues, that's it? It's our moment of zen.
Thank you, everybody. We'll see you in May, and we'll be doing a lot of emailing between now and then.